another Denkoe session. I welcome your ongoing feedback from all of you afterwards, anytime, about this kind of thing of Denkoe Sesshin and Genzoe Sesshin. I mean, they're a little bit different, but this kind of format, it's an unusual. You know, usually Sesshins aren't so much jabbering. So it's a special type. And we're, after the, our current ancestor here, there's four more before the end of the book. So, my inclination would be to do another year and finish the last through Koun Ejo, and then consider whether to go through 28 Indian ancestors and the first 5 Chinese. This I brought just as a like kind of demonstration tool, thing. This is this book by Carl Brunholtzl I mentioned. So just I don't want to read from it actually. I just want to see that there's 1,767 footnotes in the volume 1. And this huge list of Dharma things. And when I saw it on the shelf, it brought a smile, because I don't know if you saw the name of this book.
Gone Beyond.
Going Beyond Buddha. And I thought, this demonstrates it perfectly, huh? Going beyond Buddha, beyond all conceptual constructions. Beyond anything we can know and name, beyond all words. Takes the form of 1,767 footnotes to a very dense text. Maybe Carl himself saw a little humor in that title himself.
Is this your leisure reading?
Yeah, that's just like kind of entertainment reading, light reading when kind of sleepy. many words that go beyond, going beyond, expressed in many, many words. And we wouldn't want to neglect a word from our sponsor. Every time I look at this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I just think, this is like our Bible, you know. So great. So he just really says it in a way that is really accessible, and it's super profound at the same time. That's, I would think, of Suzuki Roshi's art.
We should memorize it.
I agree. Enchant it, the whole, yeah. Maybe on like New Year's Day, we could chant the whole book. That'd be interesting. I've heard that there's one American Zen temple that is in the lineage of the poet Ryokan, and they chant Ryokan's poems at their service, which I don't think is ever done in Japan. I think that's a creative adaptation. You maybe even heard this before. You probably did read it at one point, but you might have missed that this is commenting on this point of suppose I say it is such. Suppose I say it's not such. Or what's the signless sight of awakening? This painting by Scholar Wu. Going beyond Buddha. 1767 footnotes. Suzuki Roshi says in the section on believing in nothing. So it's absolutely necessary for everyone to believe in nothing. A strong statement. It's absolutely necessary for everyone to believe in nothing. But I do not mean voidness. There is something. This part sounds like Kazan. There is something. But that something is something which is always prepared for taking some particular form, and it has some rules or theory or truth in its activity. This is called Buddha nature, or Buddha himself. When this existence is personified, we call it Buddha. When we understand it as the ultimate truth, we call it Dharma. And when we accept the truth and act as a part of the Buddha, or according to the theory of Dharma, we call ourselves Sangha. But even though there are three Buddha forms, it's one existence, which has no form or color, and it's always ready to take form and color. This is not just theory. This is not just the teaching of Buddhism. This is the absolutely necessary understanding of our life. It's absolutely necessary to believe in nothing, but I don't mean voidness, because there is something. So, a modern version of something, a little bit like Kazan. Kazan says, what is more, when you utter a single word, spin thoughts and say thus or like this, you fall into the secondary and tertiary and miss the primary. Secondary and tertiary, just by saying thus. Kazan sometimes quite strict. Thinking that there was not a single point he had missed, Qian Tong said, even supposing I can express that which is beyond, I cannot put it into words for you. He did not know the true self and was still concerned with distinctions. Sounds a little funny. I can't put it into words for you. And Kazan says, he was still concerned with distinctions by saying, I can't put it into words. For that reason, Wu Kung said, you can't really express it. At that point, Tian Tong's breath stopped. He lost his power and asked, what is that which is beyond? Wu Kung replied, suppose I say it's not thus. This expression and the former one by Tian Tong of it is thus are as far apart as heaven and earth, as different as fire and water. Tiantong thought that everything was exposed, but Wukong said it was not so, saying, thus, Tiantong was merely the solitary moon, clear and bright. But when he perceived his error, he received approval. Merely the solitary moon, clear and bright. Doesn't sound so bad. So, he was the solitary, clear, bright moon of thus. But what about the dark side of the moon? It's not thus. The light and the dark together. So I just came across, you know, we have Francis Cook's translation of this Transmission of Light and Thomas Cleary's and Hubert Nierman's. And then we have this book by Lex Hickson. Have you ever seen this?
Yes.
Called Living Buddha Zen. And it's not really a translation exactly of this Transmission of Light, but a sort of interpretation. It's maybe a loose translation, because he goes through all these stories, and even the commentary parts of stories and comments on them. You know Lex Hickson?
Well, these came out of his Dokusans with
Bernie Glassman. Yeah.
So it's funny. We slid into this through discussion of Dokusan and teacher student.
Mm-hmm.
And then here is the whole kind of definitive teacher student book, The Transmission of Light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lex Hickson,
mm-hmm.
Who was sort of a seeker. He landed in a few spiritual traditions. I think he made a great connection with Bernie Glassman.
Mm.
He followed his spiritual paths.
Yeah, and he's a kind of a poet, I think, too. He's definitely a writer, and through his various spiritual paths, expressed in many ways the one reality. I appreciate him. I think he died a few years ago. I think he went pretty far along in these paths. I think he was a Soto Zen priest, maybe even Dharma transmission, and a member of some Sufi order, like ordained into some Sufi order. I think some kind of Orthodox Christian order, and a Hindu, I think Shaivite order. Not just kind of dabbling, but like really took up each one of these, and maybe more. And he has a book on Ramakrishna, the great contemporary Hindu saint, done in kind of the same style, kind of makes... He takes the record of Ramakrishna and kind of puts it into conversational form to make it more readable. And he's got one book called Coming Home. That's the kind of awakening through the lens of like six or seven different spiritual traditions. He's a real interfaith unifier and pointing right to the heart of the matter of, you know, the highest teaching and practice and realization in every tradition, showing that they're basically, if not the same, very similar. So some of these I was thinking, I don't know what I would say from his commentaries, but here about this point, Kate, I think picking up on the, he doesn't follow exactly, he just pulls bits and pieces out of Kazan's commentary. Here, I think referring to the part about Tiantong was like this solitary bright moon, nearly like that. So, Bhakshikshan says, beyond Buddha is like the dark side of the moon, which, given the nature of the solar system, will never turn in our direction, will never be illuminated for us, even by all-pervasive sunlight, will never enter into the realm of our natural perception. But we know with certainty that the dark side is there. It's implied by the bright side. It grounds the bright side. And you know how that works with how the moon rotates around the sun with in exactly the same rotation of the moon to do one rotation of the earth, so that we always see the same side of the moon. You know that? That's why, like, the man in the moon or the rabbit in the moon, it doesn't, like, turn around to the other side. It's always the same side we see due to our solar system. So the dark side of the moon is always dark. It's kind of a strange thing, actually. And light will never hit the dark side, but we know that it's there because it's one moon. Another analogy for beyond Buddha is antimatter. Although now commonly accepted, this notion shocked physicists of an earlier generation. Dongshan was like a radical physicist who saw implications far beyond what other adepts of his own era could see by coining this phrase, going beyond Buddha. Imagine as we contemplate the twin moons of Japanese Soto Zen, Dogen Zenji appears as the dark moon, impenetrable mystery, deep lotus, prajna, transcendent insight, illuminating the way, but never casting any light upon itself. Keizan Zenji appears as the bright moon, revealer of secrets, shining jewel, upaya, skillful means, skillful communication, compassionately pointing out every detail. The bright moon with luminous kindness is now pointing to the dark moon. So, through some of these discussions, can you see how we could see Dogen as the dark side of the moon and Keizan as the light? Keizan's always talking about someone, this person, something, the undying person in the hut, this kind of talk. And Dogen saying, praising going beyond Buddha. In general, these sides. Dogen Zenji's radiant darkness does not conceal. He always advocates the way of expression. So there's this. Dogen's the dark side. He advocates the way of expression, which is the light. Without thinking about it, without describing it discursively, without relying on any conventional Zen gesture, express it, reveal it. We must express realization through our very pores, like sweating, or through our very heart, like weeping or laughing. As Master Wu Kung, in this current story, suggests to his successor, if you cannot express it, you're still far from a weakness. The comparison of Dogen's and Kazan's style is the light and the dark. Of course, they're not fixed into one side or the other. But as a general tendency, I think he was onto that. So later, Tian Tong appeared as a teacher and taught Dharma. A monk asked him, "What is the way?" And he replied, "Stop standing at the crossroads, gazing into the distance." That's a nice instruction, I thought. What is the way? Stop standing at the crossroads, gazing into the distance. Picture the image. Okay, it's time to go one way or the other. But before I start walking, how's that? The road look clear that way? I can't quite see. This way. Instead of just like, take a step, flip a coin, leap one way or the other. What is the way? Stop standing at the crossroads, gazing into the distance. Nice image about non-hesitation, and don't try to figure out your life. Once, Tian Tong entered the hall and said, "Walk in the time prior to the beginning of time. Stretch out beyond the world. Wonderful realization cannot be accomplished with thought. True realization cannot be communicated with words. When you get it at once, stillness suppresses the mist, and white clouds are barred from the chilly peak. A glorious light rends the darkness, and the bright moon accompanies the boat at night." Right at that moment, how do you embody it? Relative and ultimate never leave the fundamental state. How can this situation have anything to do with words? Kazan commenting says, "Emptiness and stillness have no boundaries. Even if you cannot put it into words, you are not apart from it. This is how you must be if you want to be aware of what is beyond." Or even if you cannot put it into words, you're never apart from it. Still, sometimes we're challenged to express it. Express what we're never apart from. Still talking about mind or essential nature is not at all that which is beyond. Also just saying mountains are mountains and water is water and thinking that this is beyond is without doubt a mistake. Dungshan said, "When you experience that which is beyond Buddha, then you can express it somewhat." A monk asked him, "What are the words?" Dungshan replied, "If I say them, you won't hear them." Also, Panchan said, "The single path beyond was not transmitted by any of the sages. Truly, it's not a matter of rambling freely as one pleases, as people like to say." And it strikes me a little funny sometimes because Kazan and other of these Zen commentators seem to criticize. There were all these Zen cliches going around China and Japan after Zen started, and they're great sayings, but they say, you know, I think we could hear it like that. Don't just think it's as easy as just saying a cliche like, Well, the way is just rambling freely as one pleases. But then the irony of it is that Keizan's using all these cliches and stuff too. So maybe all with a kind of glimmer in his eye. Also, a monk asked Wu Kung, Tiantong's teacher, "What is that which is beyond?" Wu Kung replied, "That marvel exists prior to the appearance of a bubble of your body. How can it submit to the eyes of 1,000 sages?" Keizan says, "Bubble, in case you were wondering, means after your body has appeared in the womb. When it's not yet appeared, it's called that which is beyond." This is interpretation. This, what is beyond is the marvel that exists prior to the appearance of you as a bubble in the womb. Then teacher Kumu Fachang, a true spiritual heir of Furong Daokai, one of the previous ancestors we met this week, said to the monks, "When you realize that there is something going beyond Buddha and ancestors, you will be able to express it. Oh, Zen worthies, tell me, what is that beyond Buddhas and ancestors?" It's someone who lacks the six senses and whose seventh consciousness is incomplete or missing. You know, the seventh consciousness is the bifurcator, the manas, the afflicted mind that gives rise to self and other, the illusion of self and other, and dualistic thought in Yogacara teachings, and seventh consciousness. So, brings in a little Yogacara saying, this one that's beyond Buddha is someone who lacks the six senses and doesn't have this seventh consciousness that divides experience into self and objects. He's the great Ichantika. Do you remember what that is?
Some sort of bodhisattva that does bad. Some sort of evil clown. What is the story? What?
Yeah, in the Lakavatara Sutra, it's like there's a kind of bodhisattva Ichantika. And anyone remember any more? Yeah, the original, yeah, or incorrigible is one translation. The original teaching, I think, in the Parinirvana Sutra, is that Echantika is someone with no Buddha nature. As if there could be such a thing. And I think it's due to their super evil actions, like killing their parents or something, yeah. And that their, you know, their karmic obscuration is so heavy that it's as if they have no Buddha. They can never become a Buddha. It's too, their karmic weight is too heavy. But they actually have no Buddha nature, right? So then there was this whole controversy in China around this point, because it's, you know, in the scriptures, and some people say that can't be, and some people say, oh no, it was added later, and some people say, oh no, it's Ichantika, and some people said, I don't care if the sutra says it, all beings have Buddha nature, I'm going to stand up for that, and they would get like banished. So this kind of thing. And then the Lakavatara Sutra picks up on this point and says something like, it's another sutra, but maybe that came during this controversy about, could there really be someone with no Buddha nature? And the Lakavatara Sutra says something like there's a kind of Bodhisattva Ichantika that vows not to become a Buddha until everyone's free from suffering. That's the Bodhisattva vow. So in a way, they don't have the Buddha potential. But they willingly gave it up out of compassion. That's the kind of gist.
Is it related to Mara?
Ichantika? You could say maybe Mara is the creates the Ichantika. But the Ichantika is like a person who Mara has come into and taken over. The evil one has taken over a person and completely blocks their access to Buddhahood. So they say they have no Buddha nature. Talking there, like Buddha nature is kind of like this potential to manifest Buddhahood. But then there's some nuances here about Buddha nature too that we say it's not. I think a more accurate way for Dogen and others is that it's not so much like this potential to become a Buddha. It's like our true nature, fully complete already. And it's not about after countless kalpas, it will be fully manifest. It's like it's manifesting constantly. It's just that we're not aware of it. So anyway, this Zen teacher Kumu Fa Chang says the person who's gone beyond Buddha is like the great Ichantika who has no Buddha nature. Because we're talking about going beyond Buddha, so he's playing with this idea too. Going beyond Buddha is like the great Ichantika with no Buddha nature, not Buddha. When she meets a Buddha, she kills the Buddha. When he meets an ancestor, he kills the ancestor. She cannot be confined in heaven, nor can hell hold him. O monks, do you know that person? He paused for a moment and then said, when you meet him, you're dull and sleepy, and your drowsy words spill out. Another translation is, do you know that person? Face to face, yet unaware, much slumber, excess sleep talk. Maybe that one gets at it a little more, but that phrase got me wondering. Dogen brings up that story in his Going Beyond Buddha essay, and he seems to be praising this, that this is not a criticism, that this sleep talk and slumber is like a true person. So it may just mean that how do you know this one who's gone beyond Buddha? Face to face, yet unaware, like as in sleep, what you don't know, who's in front of you. And any kind of talk about it is kind of like sleep talk. As for that which is beyond, even if a Buddha were to appear, he would lose his life. Even if an ancestor appears, her whole body is reduced to powder. If he tries to enter the celestial mansions of heaven, the mansions are demolished. If he goes to hell, hell shatters at once. What do you think celestial mansions are, anyway? Where is hell? What do you mean by myriad forms? From the beginning, there are no traces. It's just like when you're asleep. You're not aware of yourself, let alone others. So this, I think, is praising sleep in this case, where your sleep is like the dark side of the moon, where you're not aware of self and others. There is no reason when you're asleep. It just clearly is the way of non-awakening. and again, like, when are these guys like kind of like criticizing and when are they like praising when they're playing with these? But I think Lex Hickson's, you know, in his conversations with Bernie Glassman, this is like praise. Non-awakening is like not Buddha. Going beyond Buddha, going beyond awakening. Actually, another translation that makes that point is, it is just clarity with no such thing as awakening. Instead of, it just clearly is the way of non-awakening. Same, different translations. These are truly the words of our eminent ancestors. If you know that which is beyond and open your eyes, or another translation says, open the eye on your forehead, you will at this time have a chance to become it. Say the word thusness, which seems pretty clean. This Kazan in his strictness, well, actually the story brings that out too, right? It's not thus. Thus, and going beyond not thus. No place to land.
And be able to talk about
it. Yeah, no place to land and then express something. And as he says, well, it's not that I can't express it, but I can't put it into words. And then the teacher says, well, then you don't really understand. So, using words freely, nothing to hold on to, and being willing to fully express, which goes back to like being ourselves completely, being willing to just be ourselves, and you know, some silly sounding expression can come out, and it's, if it's wholehearted and authentic, and we're not holding it back, then there's expression. Now tell me, what is this principle? Kazan's verse. It's like trying to drive a wedge between two planks. You can't drive in the wedge or pry them apart. Two floorboard planks. You could say one's called it is thus, and one's called it's not thus. It's like trying to drive a wedge between those two planks. You can't drive in the wedge or pry them apart. It's like trying to drive a wedge in between the bright side and the dark side of the moon and pry the moon apart. Lex Hickson had a nice comment on this. Keizan confirms in his closing poem this morning, this afternoon, this evening, that no words can describe or thought penetrate beyond Buddha, just as no thick iron wedge can separate the planks of a wood floor laid down by a master Japanese carpenter. Walking on the floor, sitting on the floor, prostrating on the floor, sweeping the floor, these activities alone can express its floorness. Why clumsily attempt to take apart what cannot be taken apart? Buddha and beyond Buddha are one. Bright and dark are one. Express fluently what is beyond expression simply by taking the path beyond. Gone, gone, gone beyond. Bodhisvaha. What is that which is gone beyond? This book was written by Carl Brunholzl. That'd be nice. We should increase the time periods for the talks, though.
By eons.
By 10,000 eons. Thoughts?
Boy, that was fun as long as you don't try to understand it.
The capping phrase for the week. Thank you very much. That was fun as long as you don't try to understand it. I think Keizan would concur, actually.
Well, an image is like, you know, trying to step when there's no step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're all connected, yeah. All these different conversations about the same inconceivable non-separation. So maybe we remember this particular floor that has very tight floorboards when we're sweeping Zendo at Zodian, we're prostrating, looking directly at it, and walking across it. Appreciating the use of this floor that we hardly ever notice, that's made up of these different floorboards that can't be pried apart, so tightly joined, so we just use it by sweeping it and walking on it and bowing on it. And maybe this week was a kind of exercise in you know, trying to drive some wedges into the nice, pristine Zendo floor between the floorboards. And just for fun, drive some wedges where they can't be driven. Between this and that, between Buddha and beyond Buddha. Now we can just go back to walking and bowing on the floor. And I'll meet you on the dark side of the moon.
Well, so much of what you read was so beautifully poetic. You know, even though there's this total confusion going on in the mind, and yet you just want to listen because it has such wonderful imagery and thought-provoking, but yeah. So poetic.
Yeah, I think that's the family style of Zen, is to not say the relative truth and the ultimate truth are actually not separate. And here's the logic behind it. You know, instead, they'll say the full moon goes along with the boat running through the water at nighttime. So it's the expression. How do we put it into expression that actually opens the mind.
As much as frustration, like I have this thing, frustration as my mind, you know, I'm listening, and then it's gone, you know, and then I just lose something I'm trying to grasp with these stories and teachings, and I'm, you know, going along and then all of a sudden. But then when you just finished with the other commentary of this modern person that you were talking about, this last little bit you read, I went, oh, well, that's clear. And then I thought, well, what use is that? What good is that, kind of, you know? I don't know, there's just this sense that...
Oh, what good is it that it's clear?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
If I have something, it's like getting something that you can put in your...
Yeah, right.
You know?
That's a great insight.
No.
I think that's maybe could be a clue as to how this family style developed. Is like these Zen ancestors are like, we don't want to like give you too many things to just put in your pocket and forget all about. That's a great point. Now we might, you know, sometimes we need a few things for our pocket to keep us going, because it's like we just keep going to the candy store and the candy seller doesn't give us anything to put in our pockets and take home. We eventually stop going to the candy store. And then we're like, well, that's just, you know, not so interesting. I think I'll instead go blow up some mailboxes. And then we get into trouble. The candy store is a sweet place to hang out, but if we take too much of it, if the shop owner always gives us something, we get spoiled and hyperglycemic. So we better get out of here. Do it again some other time. Thanks for being here, the diehards. Stragglers left in the hot afternoon.
It was the Magnificent Seven.
The Magnificent Seven.
We just wanted to see the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Waiting for the punchline, which Chuck immediately.
It ends with, it's a lot of fun as long as you don't try to understand it. So we don't know if any merit arose this week, if anything positive came out of this gathering. But just in case there were some little sugar crumbs that congeal on the inseparable floor. This week we offer those sugar crumbs to the sentient beings in the boundless universe. May all beings be happy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.